and so on. And that's because people don't, you somehow there's a notion that everyone should be the same. But if you start out from the very beginning and see this person has got these qualities, so let's develop that, you specialize from the very beginning and grant everybody. I mean, this is really the virtues of their qualities and develop them. Then you have what is actually really respect for a student's individuality. And if you're smart and astute and good observer and attached also, you might be able to tell fairly well on early in age the particular constellation of qualities of a child that would lead them toward one varna or another. And that way, it could be specialized. One year, I was running for political office. We had the In God We Trust Party for Purified Leaders. And the Prabhupada started. So I was running for Congress in Philadelphia. So I put out one of my documents was a plan for reforming education and had different parts to it. And one of them was called Respect for the Student's Individuality. And it precisely outlined this sort of a thing. Another part was teachers have to teach by example. That was another qualification. No smokers, no drinkers, and so on like that. And then a few other things that were in this proposal taken from Krishna consciousness. And I delivered this proposal at a couple of political gatherings, and I had so many people ask for copies of it, you know. And so, I mean, the political party eventually Prabhupada canceled out for various reasons, but that proposal was very interesting, how you should respect the student's individuality and if somebody is a worker. And also I said that actually we're having trouble funding the schools, and what we should do is actually, you should have academic courses in the morning. And then in the afternoon, according to a person's qualities, either government or business, they should go and be apprentices so that by the time someone graduates from high school, they're fully qualified to work. And in this way, actually, you go to a bank or to a police a station or whatever it may be, and get trained in the afternoon, because actually if you get rid of, in America, you know, you go to high school, they spend practically all day, but they have these things called homerooms, study hall, lunch hour, and you get rid of all the garbage, you can fit a full curriculum in the morning. So I proposed that and so on. Well, this is our system. It's really respect for the individuality of the student and this specialization, but the specialization works well, only when there's full respect for the specialization of the other person. There's cooperation. We discussed different ways that cooperation should be entailed. That's really the responsibility of the brahmanas, to educate everybody. The brahmanas are the educators of the whole system. They educate the kshatriyas, vaishyas, and the shudras also. They're the ones that are connected. You see, to have a real brahmana, and here I want to point out that at least two of these brahmanas and kshatriyas we have not seen. All we see are parodies or distortions of these roles, I mean in modern society. I'm also going to explain how we have not seen men and we have not seen women either. And these are also due to distortions caused by an industrial society. It's a distorted society because really, as Prabhupada said, there are a few vaishyas and everyone else is shudra. That's the nature of the society. So it's just like some social body that's a monster. So we haven't really seen brahmanas. And we haven't really even seen kshatriyas. Some vaishyas maybe, but also those people in a kind of cancerous overgrowth of their natural qualities without being balanced by other things. A brahmana, if you look at in the Bhagavad Gita, jnana vijnana. Jnana means he has knowledge of the absolute truth. And vijnana means practical application of that knowledge. In other words, can bring that knowledge to bear on the actual course of events. They can be practically applied. So the brahmana is one who has scientific knowledge of the absolute truth. It's not a person who simply has faith in God, but who knows God scientifically. Just as today we accord the title science to physicists and chemists and things like that because we think they know the truth. That's not so. To know the truth and to have scientific knowledge of God is possible with the same assurance by direct experience, by the qualified people that we would expect of anybody. Our process of knowledge, in a way, is no different from that of what goes on in science. Well, sometimes people say that here this is a religious institution, so we have faith or religion, and over there this is the university. And in this university, we have knowledge. And because you have belief, and we have knowledge. Well, this is false. It's true that we say we begin ado shraddha. First of all, there's faith, right? But when you go to a university lecture hall and sit down and open your notebook, and somebody stands up and starts talking about something you've never seen, you've never heard of before, and you write it all down very faithfully. Why do you do that? It's because you have shraddha. Well, this is the university of such and such a place. This professor has his authorized degree. Everybody says this is where you go for knowledge. I have faith. And so, you're taking, say, a chemistry course, and the man starts talking to you about protons and electrons and neutrons and energy shells and covalent bonds and all this kinds of stuff. And so you protest in the very, wait a minute, these things, what are they? How do you know they're there? They say, well, we have experiments to show it. And so this is science and it works by experiential knowledge and we have done the experiments. Anybody can perform these experiments. Oh, well, let's perform them. Well, you're not qualified to perform them yet. When can I perform them? Well, actually, to use the equipment to understand going on, first you have to learn the whole science. You have to learn everything and learn how the theories are translated into things like meter readings and colors and test tubes and all this other stuff. So once you learn the science, then you can perform the experiment. And besides that, we don't let anybody near this equipment until they're in their third year of graduate school. You say, I have to spend 7 years before I can do the experiment? They say, yeah, because then you're qualified. So they say, anybody can do it, but it turns out anybody who's been properly trained and, believe it or not, initiated, because the initiation process is called getting a PhD. That's definitely what it is. I've been through it, and that's exactly what you get initiated into a professional guild or society and become a member of a what they call a discourse community. So you get initiated, and you've bought the whole thing on faith before you actually can perform the experiments. And as it turns out, the people who actually are on the cutting edge of any science, there's, 5 or 10 people who do the experiments, and everybody else accepts it on faith. Because these are the people, these are the experts, they know how to do it, and we all accept it. Well, it's the same in Krishna consciousness. You come, here's the process, you follow the process, and you'll be able to also have direct perception of the self by realization. You'll be able to have Paresh Anubhava. The other reason people accept science is it produces results. Well, Krishna consciousness produces results also, but it's not the results maybe people are interested in. But if you want those results, we can produce the results as much as and our result is going to be human beings of good character. Their result may be ubra karma from our point of view, but it's a different result. So you can't say then that so the brahmanas are people who are scientists in knowledge of the absolute truth. There's a systematic way of cultivating this absolute truth and gaining genuine scientific knowledge, and then they know how to apply this knowledge. But in order to do this, as I mentioned earlier, you have to have the existential qualifications. One has to be situated in the mode of goodness. There are things that block experiences of transcendence. What is it that blocks experience of transcendence? Well, actually, it's sense gratification. The more we engage in sense gratification, the less we become capable of self-realization. These things are inversely proportional. You know, sense gratification goes up, self-realization goes down. Self-realization goes up, sense gratification goes down. So the brahmanas are those people who, you know, the sense gratification is down, and therefore the self-realization is up. And anybody can do this process, but they have to be committed toward this minimization of sense gratification. Bhagavatam says how much you can have to maintain a healthy body. Another interesting feature about the brahmana and his ability to have knowledge and have a position that everyone accepts is that the brahmana is socially unattached. Although he is part of the social system, the brahmana is supposed to be socially unattached, because it is material attachments which bring distortions to our knowledge, because we become materially attached to money, to name, to fame. Therefore, we develop a worldview which reflects that attachment. That a worldview which reflects our attachment is called an ideology. Generally, different class ideologies or ideologies of different groups is a Marxist term and quite a good one. When I was in college, I studied one German sociologist, Karl Mannheim, who wrote a book in English. It was translated as Ideology and Utopia. So Mannheim is the founder of what's called sociology of knowledge, or how knowledge production itself is a product of social and cultural conditions. And so he deals with this fact, the problem of this fact for politics, and the fact that different social groups have their different ideologies. He saw communism as actually the ideology of the working class, and the bureaucratic conservative ideology, and the liberal democratic ideology, and how actually these reflected the social political agenda of different groups. So ultimately Mannheim said, what are we supposed to do in this fact that all our knowledge is conditioned like that? So he calls for a class of what he calls socially unattached intelligentsia. He called it the ultimate synthesis for our time. And when I became a devotee, when I read the description of what a brahmana is supposed to be, I thought, this is what we need, a socially unattached intelligentsia. And part of that, this is the training with this, sama, dhamma, tapa, socha, shanta. These are all the qualities that one needs to be socially unattached. And also we saw the relationship of vritti. He's not supposed to be employed by anybody. As soon as you to take a paycheck, you become you're owned and controlled by the person that pays you. It may not be a very gross influence, but it's there. Sometimes it's quite gross, of course. So you notice today the position of brahmanas, they're all employees. The kind of research that people today needs funding. Who funds the research? Well, it's either government or it's business. Who funds government? It turns out to be business. And so there are the Vaishyas. The Brahmanas are really not in a position anymore, aside from other things. They have become tools of the system. And they're able, you see in America, you know, they're working, the Brahmanas are employed at Harvard and Princeton and Yale. And they espouse sometimes very radical ideas and stuff like that. But every year they turn out, the upper class, the ruling class sends their children and they turn them out very nicely to take their position in the system. They're employed and yet they're all revolutionary and they never create a single revolution. Why is that? They have so many ideas of what's wrong with society, nothing changes. Because, you know, they have their employees, they don't know the absolute truth. They're baffled. What is the truth? They're like Pontius Pilate. What is truth? You know, they can't say. People in a Vedic system, if the Brahmanas are actually socially unattached, then everybody will trust them. They have no self-interest. Their interest has to be the interest of Krishna, really. But other than that, they're people without any self-interest. A Kshatriya and a Vaishya, automatically by their role, they have to be a little more self-interested. But a Brahmana is socially unattached in intelligentsia, who can see the absolute truth. And when you hear them speak, you understand I am in the presence of an authority. This person knows. He's not some preacher who's, you know, hoping to convince me by volume or by mental manipulation, but this is someone who knows and can give direction. So he is the teacher of society. I want you to notice also in this another feature of modern society, where it's dislocated, is the huge difference between what goes on in the discourse in the intellectual community, the kind of things that the intellectuals talk about and think about, and what the rest of the people talk about and think about. They've got nothing to do with each other. Whatever goes on in academics, it doesn't trickle down. Academics, the people, the intellectuals are talking about so many different things in a specialized jargon that only the few can understand, published in specialized journals. And everybody else is being educated by Walt Disney or some equivalent like that. So there's this gap between popular culture and the intellectual culture of the academics. In Vedic culture, whatever the Brahmanas were doing, it went all the way down. So that even the popular entertainment was based on Mahabharata, Ramayana. The Prabhupada mentions that. Actually, in this society, when it was in this healthy society, the Brahmanas actually were able to educate all groups of people, not just a select few. And the rest of the people were turned over to the masters of illusion, the Steven Spielbergs and the Walt Disneys, and taught to worship the American mouse god. So we are now in this uprooted condition, and there's this huge difference that goes on. So if we look to the next level, the Kshatriyas, again, these are people with a different sort of a disposition. By the way, I'll anticipate a little bit of what I want to talk about tomorrow. That when Prabhupada says, "I've come to give you a head," and when he's talked again and again about what ISKCON is, that is to say, ISKCON is a preaching movement, he means Brahmanas. I've come to give you a head. And my conclusion is that temples and similar sorts of institutions should all be Brahminical institutions. For this reason, I think that in temples and things like that, you don't need Kshatriyas. It's true you need some management, but a Kshatriya is overkill. Because Kshatriya means recourse to violence. And that's not necessarily among Brahmanas. Also, the other thing is that when it comes to a jurisdiction, Brahmanas are not directly under the jurisdiction of Kshatriyas. Kshatriya, they do not come before the Kshatriya for judgment if they commit a crime or engage in some misdemeanor, as a usual manner. So if you have Brahmanas in ISKCON, the temple president shouldn't be a Kshatriya. It should also be another Brahmana. So sometimes people say, well, where do we have Kshatriyas? Well, I think you'll have Kshatriyas when you have large communities that are big enough to require police forces and things like that, in which Brahmanas are only a small part of that community. When you happen to have a country that's Krishna conscious. In America, it's possible that if you have a big enough community, you can have your private police force. At least the United States, private police forces are a standard thing now. Universities each have their own campus police. Shopping malls have their security police. And even large, what they call gated communities, you can't get in unless you saw a pass at the gate. They have their own private police. So you could actually do that in the United States. Actually, you have some place like Alachua, we could have our own police force, and it would be quite all right, so long as you cooperated and had good relations with the local law enforcement agencies and had your people trained properly. You could have your own little army, in effect. But Kshatriya is government. I asked Prabhupada when I was interviewing him on behalf of Back to God magazine, has Krishna created the perfect form of government? He said, yes, Kshatriyas. I was thinking of, some kind of abstract term like republicanism or democracy, oligarchy or something. He said, yes, Kshatriyas. He said the person. So I want to take advantage of Max Weber, the German sociologist, Max Weber's definition of the state. He defines the state like this, a beautiful definition. You know Max Weber? Yeah, right? Everybody does. Max Weber says the state is that organization which controls the monopoly on legitimized violence. I'll say it again. That organization which controls the monopoly on legitimized violence. That's a beautiful definition. Does everybody follow it? That's what the state is. And so this is what the Kshatriyas, they're those people who bear arms. This is a necessary function for protection internally and externally. They all do other things too. I mean, they organize, they manage. But the state works always by the threat of violence. If it's a good state, it doesn't have to use it very often. But it has that recourse. They can come and grab you and take away your freedom or kill you. And they do that by violence. They always have that threat to violence. There have been idealistic ideas that we can have societies without those things, but in practice they never work out. This was the Quaker idea, which envisioned a society of nothing but, in effect, Brahmanas. But it was never put into implementation. It was tried, actually, in my country, in the state of Pennsylvania. It was founded with Quakers, and they were going, so all the government and everybody, they were all Quakers, followers of George Fox, the Society of Friends, and who were nonviolent. And then what happened, in the western part of the state of Pennsylvania, the settlers were being raided by the Aborigines, the Indians, and they were constantly being killed and attacked. And so the settlers would go back to the government in Philadelphia and say, please send us troops, send us arms. And all these Quakers, they couldn't in good conscience do that. And people were dying like crazy. So what they did was they got out of government, turned it over to non-Quakers, and went into business. And so the saying is in Pennsylvania that the Quakers started out to do good, but ended up doing very well. But it's practically not possible. But the Kshatriya is one person. So to have Kshatriya as the essential thing to remember that Prabhupada stressed about Kshatriyas is that they were properly trained. The Kshatriyas were educated by Brahmanas. And therefore, by being properly trained, properly raised up, taught how to manage, how to govern, the violence was used constructively and not destructively. And so this is always Prabhupada's proper idea of what a Kshatriya is, that they work together with the Brahmanas. It's like the management team, you know, the Brahmins and Kshatriyas together. If you look at this definition, this chart about the Kshatriyas, first of all, it mentions, you know, not fleeing in battle, heroism, power in battle, being unconquerable, so on, ability to defeat others. I mean, they have these warlike qualities. That definitely has to be there. But also, in the Bhagavatam, Brahmanyata, faithfulness to Brahminical principles. And Brahmanyam, in the 11th canto, being always eager to serve the Brahmanas. So this is the characteristic. You wonder how can these big Kshatriyas with their weapons and their muscles listen to these skinny little guys? Well, one is the Brahmanas. Well, the Brahmanas, first of all, teach them from childhood, and therefore, if your teachers have been good, you remain forever indebted to them. If your teachers have given you something that you can actually use and profit from in your life, you never get over being indebted, and so you feel obliged. Second of all, the Brahmanas are very, very smart. And one reason is they're smart is that just by their being socially unattached. The Kshatriya is in the middle of the political hubbub, but here's his Brahminical advisor who's above it and who can give him good advice and who also is in a position to tell him when he's an idiot or when he's going to make a mistake. And we also find out from Bhagavatam that also the Kshatriyas gained special power by pleasing their Brahmanas, and they lost power by offending them. This is, again, the topic of blessings coming down. But we understand why Bali Maharaj got very strong and was able to defeat Indra, is Indra had offended Brihaspati, and the demons had pleased Shukracharya. And so therefore, the demons became strong and the devatas became weak. So that's another aspect of this situation. Again, we haven't really seen Kshatriyas. If you read Prabhupada's definition of Kshatriya, you see that that kind of a character is a chivalrous person. And chivalry has been out of date for quite some time. And for very good reason. It'll just get you killed at this point. But Prabhupada describes, for example, that when Kshatriyas would fight a battle, it would be a fairly small band of Kshatriyas going out to meet another band of Kshatriyas, and they would fight, and there would be no civilian populations involved. The chivalrous rules were women weren't supposed to be killed, children weren't supposed to be killed, an enemy who was asleep wasn't supposed to be killed, an enemy who was intoxicated wasn't supposed to be killed, and if he dropped his sword, you waited until he picked it up again before commencing the fight. These are the rules of chivalry. He says that those battles were more like sporting events, today's sporting events, than like today's wars. And people used to watch them. They were sporting events, but they were pretty heavy, I mean, because they were lethal sports. A Kshatriya is a person who can keep their mind fixed and their composure in the middle of death and carnage. A battlefield is a particularly horrible place. It was even so way before the invention of weapons. I once saw some of modern weapons, I mean to say, of weapons. But even when they're just swords and bows and arrows, a battlefield was a place where there were lots of body parts all over the place. People would get decapitated, dismembered, and eviscerated. And there's lots of blood. There's a description of a battle outside of the walls of Mathura in the Krishna book, which is no exaggeration. And I've done a little research into this. There's a military historian called Keegan who wrote a book called The Face of Battle and described actual what a battle was like under Alexander the Great and on up to modern times. And in every case, it is a tough environment. And it takes a very special person to have the composure to stay in that battlefield without going stark raving mad. It takes a kshatriya. And not only have composure, but if you're a commander, you have to make decisions on the spot with insufficient information, and if you make a mistake, people die. And you still have to make those decisions with complete confidence and carry them through. It takes quite a special person. Kshatriyas are people who are willing to lay down their lives in the course of their occupation. And when there's a necessity, they go out there and they'll risk their lives for everybody else. This kind of idea of battlefield, this kind of sort of way of fighting war was up until maybe the Battle of Waterloo. It's not so long ago that it stopped. I read the description of the Battle of Waterloo. It happened not too far from here. Wellington and Napoleon. And it was fought in kind of a valley area where the soldiers were. And all along the road, along the ridge, there were the town folks in their carriages watching the battle. The civilians, just like we would go to a stadium and watch a sporting event. And naturally, once in a while, there's a little dangerous, some scattered shot may fly off, a cannonball bounce off in the wrong direction. But that's just like what happens when people go to, say, automobile races once in a while. One of those cars going to the stands. because the Kshatriyas fought each other. They didn't fight civilians. But now, because of now, what we fight today is modern industrialized warfare, and that came in, in the 1860s. Really, the first place I think that you begin to see the effects of that was the American Civil War. That's when the machine gun was actually invented. It was a revolving barrel. In fact, it was so lethal that they hardly ever used it. People were scared to death of it. Although in World War I, it came fully into its own. That's where industrial production really becomes the key to winning a war. And you get the amplification. Before that, you can see that. And of course, the real change came with the invention of rifles with gunpowder, weapons of gunpowder. Then physical strength didn't matter much anymore, as much. A kshatriya had to be a very skilled person, able to deal with a bow and arrow, deal with a sword. And when you could just stand off at a distance and point a gun and go bang, it put an end to a great deal of skill and training. In fact, in feudal Japan, when they first encountered firearms, where the warriors were very adept in swordsmanship, they tried to keep it out of Japan for years. Because here you are with your sword, and somebody could just stand at a distance. Anybody, woman, child, it could be anybody, bang, 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 and there's your warrior. No, 10 minutes training, a little bit of training, and there was your warrior gone. So, and they called the name of the pistol in the American West was the Equalizer. Some little short, runny, weak guy, once he had a gun, he was as good as anybody else. His bodily strength, his prowess, and it didn't really matter if he could just point and shoot. and shoot fast, bang, 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 you know, get off so many shots. So this began to change the face of warfare, these chemical, these gunpowder weapons. And people, inventors and manufacturers got together, naturally they wanted to invent more and more lethal weapons. And so you begin to see in World War One the beginning of really mechanized warfare. The tank was invented there, the machine gun was invented there. And when in a very sporting mood, the soldiers went over the trench and charged at machine guns and, just were mowed down by this incredible firepower. In fact, when the British led one charge out of the trenches, the first guy leading the charge toward the machine guns was kicking a football. Just to show you, you know, they still had that sporting spirit. But the end of the sporting spirit came when in a half an hour you had 20,000 people dead by this machine gun. And that was the end, pretty much the end of chivalry. Sometime in World War One at Christmas time, the two opposing sides would get together and have a Christmas party, but that was the last time that happened. We read about the Kruzhchev, everybody would get together and, you know, nice, you take a bath and cool off and have a feast and back to, this modern warfare turns out to be quite a different thing. Then, of course, what they have to do is, because now what you really have to do is bring as much firepower to bear at a certain time, in a certain place at a certain time, and you have weapons, you no longer need very much training. Now you don't need kshatriyas. Now you can just have a draft, get somebody off the farm or wherever, put them in training for 6 weeks, teach them how to shoot a gun, and put them in the field for the war. And you see, the problem is with the military in this way, this is based on research, is that in a warfare, say in World War II, this is on all sides, that a soldier in combat had an effective fighting time of about 2 weeks maximum. If after 2 weeks the soldier was not a physical casualty, it was a psychological casualty. It just was not possible. A battlefield is a horrible place anyway, and it takes a special person, as we said, to stand up to it, not just anybody, a kshatriya. But then in the modern battlefield, at least in the olden days, in the days of chivalry, it made a difference if you had skill or not. You could do things to stay alive or not stay alive. On the modern battlefield, it doesn't make any difference. There are weapons of mass destruction aimed at you. There's machine guns. There's artillery. These things just blow up people indiscriminately. There's landmines. Your skills make less and less of a difference. And so a big problem for the military means how to minimize these psychological casualties. In World War One, it was called shell shock. When a person, in World War II, they called it combat fatigue. Now it's called post-traumatic stress disorder. But it's the same thing as people who just go nuts. And for very good reason. They just have a total mental breakdown in the face of the horrors of a battlefield where, and at any minute you're going to die. People are all around you being blown into bits. Many people get wounded not by weapons, but by flying body parts, teeth, bone fragments, and things like that. It is something. And even if you're a kshatriya, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference what your skills are. It gets worse naturally the armies of all countries like to watch and see a battle to see what happens. And so the Arab-Israeli war that took place, whom was that? Yeah, sometime in the late 60s, early 70s, 67, yeah, the Arab-Israeli war, where was the latest generation of weapons put to test. Well, at that point, there were now wire-guided missiles to take out tanks, They were starting to have what they call smart weapons. And during that warfare, they could see the incredible rate at which the modern battlefield chewed up machinery and soldiers. It was fantastic. And so they began to realize that the planners and the Pentagons of the world and so on else, they began to realize that the real issue now for the modern war, the modern ground war, not talking about the when it goes nuclear, but the modern ground war, nuclear, tactical nuclear weapons, but I mean not strategic, the real problem is resupply. You have to be able to get in machinery and soldiers at an incredible rate because they're just being chewed up. One person in our temple who was a United States Marine, they told him he was in a heavy weapons platoon, carried a 50 caliber machine gun. His life expectancy in battle was 13 seconds. That resupply becomes the issue. And simply you feed in personnel and weapons into the battle zone, and the one that runs out first loses. That's basically what it comes to in the modern battlefield. And that's why, the draft has to be there. That's why let us get weapons that are easier and easier to use. If you hold like a modern weapon that the modern armies use, they're made of plastic. They feel just like toys. You hold down the trigger, and your target will dissolve into a bloody mist in a second. The firepower is so lethal. There's lots of diabolical things. Weapons are designed more to maim than they are to kill, because it's a greater burden on the enemy to have to take care of wounded than to take care of dead. So it's better if it just rips your arm or legs off or does something horrible and leaves you alive. I mean, it's far out, these guys. The way they figure this stuff out. That's why I guarantee you the future is women in battle, because they're going to run out of men, they'll put in women. Again, the same thing. Two weeks training. Here's a weapon. Go in there. Because they'll, and children. Have you noticed these pictures of these 14-year-old kids in Africa with the Uzis and the AKs and flip? They're good soldiers. They can lay down firepower as much as anyone else. And in the Iran-Iraq war, Iran was sending children in, boys in that case, they were sending in children. Because of that factor, that you just have to keep, supplying huge amounts. And now, of course, you have the added factor of chemical and biological weapons. It's still getting more lethal. Even if people are not using tactical or battlefield nuclear weapons, now you have the fuel-air weapon, which creates a mushroom cloud. This weapon, like about, a couple of hundred meters over the ground, It very quickly spreads a spray, an aerosol, a fine mist of gasoline over, a few city blocks and ignites it. And there's so much surface area, the explosion is so intense that everybody under that is killed. Even if you're underground, you'll be asphyxiated, the air will be gone. And it's as good as a nuclear weapon, the fuel air weapon. They were used in the latest war against Iraq. And now biological weapons and chemical weapons, forcing the soldier in battle to fight now in some kind of suit, which increases the isolation, increases in terror. And the cutting edge of military research is now the chemical soldier, trying to find the drugs to give soldiers that are able to fight them effectively, but combat or repress their sense of fear. That's the future that's being planned, and it's being planned right now. That's what's happened to Kshatriyas. That's modern mechanized. Well, that's also a distortion. That's where we've gone along this way, just by the fact of the industrial production being the cutting edge of war, and of course, really. The real center of power in the Pentagons or whatever is not really the generals who even fight the wars, but the generals who work with the manufacturers to procure the weapon systems. That's where the real power and the real money is. And the competition is to produce these more and more lethal weapons. And that's the state of the world. In the modern armies, we don't really see real kshatriyas. I grew up in a military family. My father was a professional army in the American, a professor officer in the American army. I lived in Germany for a while while he was rehearsing World War III. With a tank battalion, so I know something about this side of life, having grown up in that that atmosphere. Feel something those people that really have it in the modern army are considered to be wild cards. It's really a bureaucratic organization now. It's a modern bureaucratized organization, and it's basically it's like a big business more than anything else. So we haven't really seen kshatriyas either. Prabhupada said things like the head of state should be at the head of the battle, not sit behind and send people out to die. You can't do that either. If you've got a battlefront that's 15,000 miles wide, it's hard to be at the front line and so on. Again, when we come to Vaishyas, now the Vaishya, they don't protect the cows. That tendency, you notice here, it says that in the characteristics of Vaishyas, in the 11th canto, no matter this atushti artha, Upachayai, they are never satisfied no matter how much money they get. They always want more. This is one of the natural qualities of a Vaishya. But if it's agrarian based and also there's cow protection, there's a natural check on this the tendency to acquire. If that's gone, that and now also the Brahminical check is gone, it just goes crazy. And that's the result of society today, is this distortion of things. So that's one thing I wanted to point out, that we haven't seen real Brahmins, real Kshatriyas, or actually even real Vaishyas at all in our experience. We're looking for this caliber of person. As far as the monarchical system of government goes, Prabhupada talks about monarchy a lot. But he also says that actually it doesn't matter what the system of government. If you have trained people, it's fine. If you have actual kshatriyas, however they get there, that's fine. If you look at the obligations of a kshatriya, by the way, you want to know what the state's supposed to do? If anyone is unhappy, the state has not done its job. If there is anyone hungry, the kshatriya is responsible. Anyone. If there is anyone who is unemployed, the kshatriya has not done the job. His obligations are to maintain these things. He's responsible for that. That's really the obligation of a kshatriya. And when the brahmanas are teaching, then you have an ethics of obligations, and people are held to their obligations and taken very, very, very seriously. It's the cement which holds everything together. Now, of course, the reason if say we democratically elected somebody who was a qualified kshatriya, then really you just keep re-electing them. The reason we need to change government all the time, or is to have in effect, periodic revolutions, one party leaves, is that everyone is incompetent because there are no trained persons. But guarantee if you had a trained kshatriya, you knew how to do his job, once you got him there, you'd say, let's keep this guy no matter what. You'd want him. And so, for that reason, at that point, you might as well have monarchy. But if that scares people, then you can do a democracy, and you could just keep re-electing the same person over and over and over again, because you would. There wouldn't be any necessity. So really, Prabhupada wasn't particularly attached to this form of government or that form of government. Although if you had really kshatriyas, you'd probably naturally end up with a monarchy and leave it at that. The reason we don't have monarchy is we don't trust anybody with that amount of power, because everybody is untrained. But if you were trained from the beginning how to use your power properly, then nobody would mind on this. Now I want to talk about another aspect of this system. Here we've talked about how everyone becomes a specialist and cooperates together. And I mentioned we haven't seen the other side of this, men and women. I read you in the beginning these five verses about Sri Dharma. And this is one of the harder things, just like it's hard for us to understand monarchy or to understand so many aspects of this system. It looks like tyranny. So this idea of men and women together and women being protected. Again, people have rejected, women especially have rejected the protection of men, and for very good reason. They were not being protected. They're being exploited and abused and everything else. You can understand that. And there's no need to quibble about it. Because men haven't been men. And therefore women said, so we're not going to be women either. We'd rather take care of ourselves. And you can see why. So if you want to put the blame anywhere, you can blame the men. I don't mind being blamed. I don't want to tell you about, anyway, my life before Krishna consciousness. In the 1920s, the English writer Virginia Woolf remarked that it was the tendencies of the sexes to become more and more alike, a prophetic insight. She said the future of the human race is androgyny, someone who's both man and woman at the same time. And so this is actually another feature of industrial society, is to gradually make gender differences less and less apparent. The loss of differences of gender between men and women. And also, again, the Vedic system, there was a system of specialization. Men had certain specialized duties, and women had certain specialized duties. And now, because that's been eroded, now we want to say, well, what's man and what's woman? That's sort of a social concoction. Of course, in our philosophy, they're not concoctions. If you're a Mayavadi, yeah, maybe. But ultimately, we have the supreme male Krishna and the supreme female Radharani. So there in the absolute truth, there's, male and female. And Prabhupada said there's male and female down here because there's male and female up there. So this difference between male and female, we can't just attribute to some social convention or even, arbitrary biology. It's there in the absolute truth. And the Vedic system is basically to say that the best thing is for the men to be males and for the women to be females. That's the best situation. If there's such a thing as masculinity, then to get the full, benefit of those particular constellation of characteristics, you need people who are specialists in being masculine. The best specialists in being masculine are in fact men, according to the Vedic situation. And again, you need people who are specialists in being feminine. Those people are best ones to do that are in fact women. Now, it is a fact that you can take a woman and turn her into a pretty good man, and you can take a man and turn him into a pretty good woman. I've seen it done with a great deal of success. Sometimes you had to look twice. And especially, with modern medicine, you can do an even more thorough job. But you can say, you know, why go to all that trouble? But to me, it seems that this is where the idea of protection of women has a certain social payoff. Because if, from my observation, if you want those particular values called feminine, which we usually call caring, nurturing, maternal kinds of abilities and values to flourish, then that they flourish in a protected environment. That's what seemed to be the nature of things. That if women are protected, then they can develop those particular feminine qualities, which are, I guess you could call them delicate, sensitive, and so on, under protection. Now, it's a fact we've seen, you know, that these are things that only men can do. Only men can be lawyers. Only men can be doctors. Only men can be this. And women do them, and they do it perfectly well. That's quite quite obvious that happens. But there's a price you probably pay for that, and the price you pay for it is that specialists in their feminine qualities and values start to disappear. What price do we pay for that loss? And also, you know, the masculine complement to that also becomes eroded, what goes together in the modern industrial society with this merging of the sexes is also the gradual disappearance of the family as a fundamental social unit. First, it was the extended family in pre-industrial times. Then it was what they called the nuclear family. Now, of course, the style is what sociologists call the modern Western style of marriage is serial monogamy. One partner, but one after another. So the family is no longer a continuous unit. It's stepchildren living with step, you know, and there's very complicated relationships are developing in this way. And because divorce is part of this erosion of the family. And of course, we're growing up in this environment. Now, if we stop for a minute and we go back to the idea of an agrarian culture, and you can see where Prabhupada is coming from. Agrarian village life is very much family-centered, and as I said, children are an asset. So that typically, you know, large number of offspring is typical, because they can begin to make an economic contribution and participate in the family activities, economic activities, from an early age. We even see that today in India. A man will be a shopkeeper, not necessarily on a farm, but, you know, his six-year-old son will be there learning how to make change with him, like that. You see it all the time. So large families are valuable. If you don't have children, it's not only an emotional disaster, but it's a financial disaster. Whereas in an industrial economy, a lot of children is a financial disaster. How are you going to educate them? How can you afford them? And so in an industrial economy, the premium is on not having children. That's why same-sex marriages look perfectly reasonable, because there's a lot of marriages of men and women which are no different at all from same-sex marriages, except that one happens to be male, one happens to be female. Otherwise, they're structurally exactly the same. Because there's a premium on not having children. Or, you know, you just have one as a hobby and spend $350,000 and something, and then they go away. They don't stick around. So that's the reason why. But if large families are an asset, then immediately you see what happens. Is that bearing and raising children becomes very much more important function. The liberation of women from traditional roles is always at the expense of the activities of childbearing and raising. Those have to be delegated somewhere else or distributed in some other place. That particular business taking care of children goes to daycare centers, or somehow the man is supposed to also do it. Don't seem to be as good at it, but given time. Now, Prabhupada talks about here how children are supposed to be raised, and I think the result of this modern destruction of the family and also the obliteration of gender differences is going to be felt mostly in the fact that you are going to get psychologically disabled people as a result. Because the children will not be cared for properly in the womb, neither in their first 5 years. And those are the most crucial periods for raising a mentally healthy child. And that's, unfortunately, you know, those activities have been devalued in our society, but they're actually the most important activities. Prabhupada mentions that in Vedic culture means that until a child is five, you spoil them. And now I'm going to read you what he says by, what he means by spoil. Because what we mean by spoil a child is different from what Prabhupada means. This is from 10th canto, 15th chapter, verse 44. Prabhupada says, Mother Yashoda and Mother Rohini, acting most affectionately toward their two sons, offered all the best things to them in response to their every desire and the various appropriate times. Purport. The word param ashishaha indicates the attractive blessings of a loving mother. Remember, we discussed blessings yesterday. Ashisha is the word for blessings. And this is parama ashisha, the highest blessing. The highest blessings. And Prabhupada describes it, the attractive blessings of a loving mother, which include wonderful food, beautiful clothing, jewelry, toys, and constant affection. The words yatha kaman yatha kalam indicate that although Yashoda and Rohini satisfied all the desires of their sons, Krishna and Balaram, they also properly regulated the boys' activities. In other words, they prepared wonderful food for their children, but they saw to it that the boys ate at the proper time. Similarly, their children would play at the proper time and sleep at the proper time. The word yatha kamam doesn't indicate that the mothers indiscriminately allowed the boys to do whatever they liked, but in the proper civilized way, they showered their blessings upon the children. So this is what do children need? And this is you, not just God. All children, wonderful food, beautiful clothing, jewelry, toys, and constant affection. And it's this deprivation of the constant affection or the attractive blessings of a loving mother that I think has caused the most destruction in modern society, and why, you know, mental disease is always constantly on the rise. There's some local empirical research in support of this, which I want to cite. First of all, as far as empirical research goes, when I was growing up, I was told that the child in the womb is sort of like the child is sort of like in a bubble, and perfectly protected. And we were told about the old old wives' tale, that of prenatal influence, that the mother was disturbed or shocked or something that would affect the child. And now we know that's all false, but now we know it's true. That the child in the womb leads a very active life, and what the mother is eating, what emotions the mother is feeling, what sounds are being heard. They're all transmitted through the child in the womb. I would suspect that if a mother decides to kill the child knows it on a certain level. There is actually a great deal of prenatal influence on a child that empirical research has borne out. And I would say that actually what every child needs is a sanctified womb, a womb of a Krishna-conscious mother who takes care of the child even from the beginning. And therefore you get these sort of old-fashioned ideas of what pregnant women should do and shouldn't do. There seems to be something to that. Similarly, early childhood development, it was just Newsweek magazine came out a whole article about children. And the discovery is that very young children, their neurological development, the actual development of neural connections in the brain, is dependent upon an environment of high stimulus. And the right stimulus, the appropriate stimulus, says it won't do to set them in front of a TV set. It has to be human interaction. Human interaction which knows when to be there and also knows when to quit. And on this basis, children develop mentally very much. And it says, you know, well, we have to start rethinking things about sending kids to daycare centers, putting them in front of TV sets. You know, maybe mothers should have more than just maternity leave to have babies. They should be able to actually stay at home with the children for a while, or somebody should, like this. So I think maybe people are beginning to understand, actually, what's required. Children need, as Prabhupada said, constant affection. They have constant affection until they're 5 years old. They need it for their emotional security. You want to have people who don't have a sense of, what do you call, low self-esteem? This is how you get it. A child has to feel, when they're 1 to 5, look, they're in Maya. They have to feel affection. And they have to feel loved beyond all measure. They absolutely need that. And the best persons to do that are attractive mothers. And to get attractive mothers, eventually, I think we need to have specialists. We need to have people who are protected so that they can develop those qualities. On this basis, on the children, the whole society, the future of the whole society depends. And it begins in the womb. It begins actually with Garbhadhana Samskara. That's when it begins. And so if we take all this into account, we should understand why this specialization between men and women, and why what the effect of this protecting women is supposed to do. That's my conclusion about this thing. I think that modern society is a disastrous experiment, and it'll come crashing down. I don't know how long. It's probably crashing now, but it's just in kind of slow motion from our perspective. And if we're going to have a human society, we have to take all of these things into account. When Prabhupada is telling these things, he's giving us something that's very, very deep and is based on incredible wisdom that has come down from thousands of years, and it should not be lightly discarded. And we should try to take it seriously. So that's my take on this role of specialization, and why I think that the protection of women forms an actual asset. If men are not the kind of people who can give shelter to women and protect them, then there's a disaster. Naturally, women are not going to want to be protected. You know, because you ask, who's going to protect us from our protectors? You know? So the social disorder is coming in this way because people are not fulfilling their obligations. Men are not fulfilling their obligations to women. Women are not fulfilling their obligations to children. And it's a mess right now. But it's our job supposed to be to set it right. I'll stop there. The vital question is, how do we get there from here? And I have some ideas. By the way, in outlining these social roles for men and for women, I just want to say it is not my job that we say to every woman, okay, you know, you got to be like this now. We are what we are. We may be the products of all kinds of, you know, we're mixed up. Nobody knows whether I'm a Kshatriya, Brahmin, Vaishya, Shudra, and a lot of us whether I'm a male or female. That's okay. You know, we'll take what we've got and use it in Krishna's service. That's, you know, but this is where we've got to, we ought to think that we really have to go to, in my judgment. So, questions? Yes.
As a devotee, should one follow an authority who cannot give protection to women, children, and cows?
As a devotee, should one follow an authority who cannot give protection to women, children, and cows? It depends on the circumstances. It's certainly not necessary. As I mentioned earlier, when there were improper authorities in ISKCON, Prabhupada got on the devotee's case for not doing anything about it. He said you should not have surrendered your intelligence. So when authorities are improper, it's our duty to say something about it. Now we may have to do it in the right delicate way, in the proper way, because we don't want to. There's a principle also, and the principle is that when authorities are improper, we still have to respect the concept of authority. In our revolutionary period, when we see authorities are no good, let's get rid of authorities. When we had the guru reform movement back in the 80s, mid-80s in the United States, at that time, at the very beginning, there were some people who would really try to find out, how can we get rid of gurus altogether? Can we just do without them? Not that we get gurus who are doing things right, but actually we shouldn't have gurus. These people became, you know, the Ritvik movement. But the real motive was, let's get rid of gurus. So that's the problem in dealing with it. It's a delicate matter. So when there was an improper authority, Prabhupada also appreciated the fact that devotees stuck to their duties and the Krishna consciousness movement went on. But while he wanted them to stick to their duties, at the same time, they were not supposed to blindly follow. So there's supposed to be rectification on this thing. And there's many questions. You know, you can look about in the Bhagavatam. We see instances of improper authorities and how they were dealt with. King Vena is one of them. And what was his name? Ramachandra Puri, Lord Chaitanya's godbrother, who was Ramachandra Puri. These are interesting. Well, yeah, that's a long discussion. But you certainly shouldn't just allow it to go and support such things in silence. How you go on from there, that depends on the circumstances, what can be done. Okay? Yeah?
As you said, that you like to be born as Shamadharma, but at the same time, yeah, you're preaching your movement, and sometimes women are as forced, but I have to have leader position.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sometimes difficult to get retired from the preaching,
yeah,
because
sure.
You get to have children,
mm-hmm.
So it makes some confusion.
Yeah, I understand the problem. Well, you know, that's not all exactly all of our ashram dharma, and I said we also have this kind of Vaishnava side. It's not just that we have this Varnashram system, but if everyone's a Vaishnava, it means not the Brahmanas don't have the monopoly on preaching. Kshatriyas are supposed to preach, Vaishya is supposed to preach, Shudras are supposed to preach, men are supposed to preach, women are supposed to preach. But I would guess when we articulate things properly, we'll be able to find ways for everybody to do it most compatible with their position. So meanwhile, I understand that we're all in dilemmas. We're asked to do different things at the same time that we can't do together. I understand that. And I would just deal with these things on a case-by-case basis. I wouldn't want to say, you know, because a woman is busy preaching or managing or something else and is not being a mother, that, you know, she's some awful, horrible person. I shouldn't take that from here at all. I'm just trying to point out where we want to go. But now, you know, a lot of times our movement is, you know, the problem with our movement is that it's unformed. I mean, it's embryonic. It's not all together. When Prabhupada started, it was almost working under emergency conditions. And in many cases, we're still working under emergency conditions. So all kinds of things are being done that we have to do that later on, you know, we might want to change.
You mean a few centuries or something?
What? Well, Krishna's in charge of timing. And how fast some things take sometimes depends upon us, how much we surrender to Krishna. But I hope it's not a few centuries. I hope we're within a matter of decades. See, a lot of the pace at which we develop toward Varnashram Dharma is also determined about what changes are happening in the surrounding society. That will also depend on that too. So I can't tell you right now what the timing is going to be. And of course, the Vedic time will be very fast, but our time it may be slow. Maharaj?
The topic of yesterday's discussion was brooding in me over the night, or I was thinking about it. But yesterday you said that the medicine of renunciation has to be administered differently to different patients. You said how in India people are so much in this family consciousness. Their individuality is the concept of a we as a family or as a group. And therefore, because they are so very much attached, like all of us who have been in India have seen, the stress on renunciation had to be very strong, which is what we find in the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then you said, but because we Westerners have become so irresponsible in our relationships, therefore this medicine of renunciation may sometimes be too strong and divest us of our humanness.
Yeah, that's what I said.
Now, I thought it was a wonderful observation. Now my question comes, did you mean this for the Grihastha devotees only, or is it applicable equally to the Brahmacharis and possibly Sannyasis?
Many Brahmacharis ultimately get married simply because they have no relationships of affection, and we won't call it attachment, Smita Krishna said maybe affection, but there have to be affectionate relationships among Vaishnavas also. If I think that being detached means I have no human relations, of course, a spiritual relation means that in any relationship, whether it's between two male devotees, two female devotees, between a man and a woman, Krishna has to be the center term of the relationship. It's always a triad in Krishna consciousness, minimally. Krishna has to be the center term. That being said, you know, there's no those relationships have to be there. Another thing is that most of us who came to the movement, many of us came to the movement fleeing human relations. Remember attachment, fear, and anger? What's the fear of? The fear of being human beings. Because we've seen in material society how horrible human beings are to each other. We think, let's take the spiritual life. And then when we find we have to become persons again, we become frightened. We should not be frightened. Of course, you know, then we find out that these bad human relations going on in ISKCON, it's another shock. But it takes time to recover. That's all. That's all I can say. You know, the degree to which we come from a diseased society and therefore have internalized disease conceptions of life is very deep, and you know, every year I discover how deep it is, so there should be proper relationships like that. You know, we did these weird things. You know, you told 6-year-old kids in the Gurukula they shouldn't be attached to their mothers. I mean, what insanity is that? You know, well, we tell no one should be attached, and told mothers they shouldn't be attached to their children. I mean, that was at the wrong time in the wrong place. You know, there's a proper time for attachment or affection, if you want to call it that, and then the time for renunciation is there also. You have to be a human being Well, that's what we did, you know. Instead of making, sometimes instead of making things better, you made things worse.
Many times, critics within our movement and also outside say that the brahmacharis and sannyasis behave unhuman towards the opposite sex. Now, you have just said the relationship should be human and not, mm-hmm. we should not run away from relationships. Mm-hmm. Do you have any new perspectives on
let me just deal with my own ashrama. I mean, tough enough.
How brahmacharis and sannyasis should behave humanly towards the opposite.
Yeah, human means with respect. As Aretha Franklin was saying, R-E-S-P-E-C-T. With respect. It's an American song. All I want is a little bit of respect. R-E-S-P-E-C-T. A woman sang that song. It doesn't mean one should not establish intimate relationships. That's obviously true, or casual friendship, but, you know, because the vows are there. But people should be respected. You know, it probably said, like your mother. But, you know, my God, how have we treated our mothers? So we have a long ways to go. My mother, I never want to see that. You know. So it's tough.
Isn't it difficult for a, let us say, 28-year-old Western brahmachari to see an 18-year-old brahmacharini like a mother? But I have been asked mm-hmm. how to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I usually, in my case, maybe it's because I'm older, a householder, I usually say, you know, 18 is daughter. 30 is mothers, you know, something like that. Yeah.
In some cultures, that's institutionalized. In Latin America, and no Latin Americans here, but if you, it's still tradition, it's still cultures. You'll see some, say, a woman selling flowers, mm-hmm. and it's madre cuante vale esto, mm-hmm. mother, how much do these flowers cost? Mm-hmm. And if it's a little girl, madre cita cuante vale esto. Little mother, how much?
A little mother. Okay, little mother's good. That's nice. I like little mother. That's a good one. Little mother's great. I hear that in translations of Russian novels too. Little
yeah,
mother.
Russian.
Russian. I think Russian also. Yeah, I like little mother. I guess it's time for the next episode on psychological development. Yeah.
Well, maybe you'd like to make it.
Yeah, I already said it, but you say it too.
Oh, your class, fifth class. Begins at 9:40 tomorrow morning, same place.
Okay, and then we'll continue. I'm sure people have a lot more to say about this, and we'll try to recapitulate and wind up and talk about how we get there from here and see what ideas we have. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. Just want to cover, I have some topics I'd like to cover and then answer questions. People have been handing me, you know, things from yesterday's class. Maybe we can try to get to some of them. But the topic I wanted to address today is, if we say what our get an idea of what this Varnashram Dharma means, and if we accept it as a goal, then one of the big problems is, what do we do to get there from here? Because one thing is, it was clear to me that, you know, to have a real Varnashram system, you need an agrarian economy. And here we are in the middle of an industrial society. And even if we have some farm communities here and there for preaching and everything, we're still going to be in the middle of an industrial society. And we're going to be making devotees, recruiting them out of industrial societies, and they won't be trained for a Varnashram society. So this is how to get there from here. I have several suggestions which I would like to mention. Prabhupada kept talking about ISKCON as a Brahminical institution, come to give you a brain. So many times he says this is the function that he particularly for society wanted ISKCON to do. And on this matter, I believe that one of the first steps and something that's starting is we have to see ISKCON, that is to say the temples and associated institutions, and even some of the communities around temples, as primarily educational institutions. There is an order of Prabhupada's that he gave, and which was an order that his disciples were, for whatever reasons, unable to follow. And it was one he talked about quite a bit, and which he laid great importance on. And still, just when it came to doing it, everybody kind of, I don't know, just didn't have what it took. And this order is that there should be a system of education in ISKCON with a degree program of Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhava, Bhakti Vedanta, and Bhakti Sarvabhauma. So here you have one great, big, fat, unimplemented order for a long time. And the fact that we are didn't implement it, I think, was related to Prabhupada's criticism. You think my books are just for distributing and not for studying. I think if we actually implement that order and think of ISKCON as an educational institution, especially the temples, as places of, Patana Patana. One studies the Vedas and teaches it to others. And therefore primarily as Brahminical, that will be a very big start. From that, so many other things will be clear. See, sometimes if you don't take step one, then step two and step three are not clear. But immediately you take step one, then the next step gets illuminated, then you take that step, and the next step gets illuminated. So if we can't see very far in the direction, it may be that certain things we have to do first, then we'll see. So this is one of them, because the depth of instruction and understanding that's in Srila Prabhupada won't really be revealed to us until we take it seriously. And I think on this matter, the governing body of ISKCON has become pretty convinced. We've discussed this several times, and now almost everyone on the GBC sees this as a future of ISKCON, that it becomes an educational institution. What does it mean? Well, I would say it would mean, like, for example, somebody wants to come and live in the temple, join a bhakta, bhakti program. That should just be like enrolling in school. You should have a curriculum. Half the day's classes, other half of the day, things like, sankirtan and practical things like that. And there's a course of study, the classes you have to take when you get Bhakti Shastri, then you can be initiated or something like that. You can work it out. So that everywhere the temples are like that. They're run just like divinity schools for training of people. Some people may stay for a long time in the temples and continue that function, but many other people, maybe most people, will come stay in the temples a while, learn Krishna consciousness, become initiated devotees, and then move out in some other capacity. But that should be our primary aim. The temple should also, their function to the rest of society, through congregation, for example, to their own children going up through the age brackets, to the adults who continue in Krishna consciousness, should all be to provide constant continuing education from age, from kindergarten up to graduate school and beyond, and also laterally throughout all different sectors of society. And this is what we're at Abhintoya, when we had that conference, this is what we elaborated on. And so I think that's something that's happening. And so in this way, will become more and more of a Brahminical society, at least a section of it. So that's one thing I think that really has to happen next, and is in the process of happening that way. We've also, I mean, when I was a devotee in academics, I was practically the only one. Now there are many, many other devotees getting into academics. This is, I think, something also. Prabhupada wrote in one letter that there are so many departments of religion I want that are mentioned. It's not that academic life is for everybody, but there's a level of society, of karmic society, in which we are not yet able to engage in discourse with in a way that will be respected by people going to graduate school and things like that. They're learning how to engage in that kind of discourse, and this is a and when we do so, people are rather startled about Krishna consciousness. And so they can begin to start to see what we have. Theologians who have listened to devotees, see, they won't listen to some guy in the street with a book. I mean, that's they're snobs. And in order for them to listen to you sometimes, you have to be able to use the kind of language and to have the same body of references that they have. Then they'll listen. That's why I said a PhD is really initiation into a discourse community.